68. Right now, 68 in Kenosha, 65 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, viewers have the opportunity to see yet another fascinating, wonderfully crafted documentary film under the heading of American Experience, one of the most renowned programs to air on PBS over the last several decades. And this particular film is one I enjoyed immensely, in part because I'm a president's nerd, someone who can rattle off all of the U.S. presidents in order, but not the vice presidents. And the story of the place of the vice president in American history and the way in which that place and understanding of the importance of the office, the recent change in that, is explored in a new film called The American Vice President. And I am so happy to be reconnecting with Michelle Ferrari, who wrote, produced, and directed this marvelous film. We have spoken several times before about some of the outstanding films she has created for American Experience, including, I think, maybe right off the bat, maybe one of the first conversations was about her marvelous film, Seabiscuit. Also, we spoke about Edison and The Vote, a film about Kit Carson, and again, most recently now, we talk about this film that airs tomorrow night on American Experience, a film called The American Vice President. Michelle Ferrari, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much, Greg. Thanks for having me back.
I am really happy to be talking with you, and I truly loved this film. Was it your idea to create a documentary about the vice presidency and how it has changed in recent decades?
Absolutely not. It was a commission. American Experience came to me and said they wanted an election season special about the vice presidency. And I will say that I found the brief quite daunting to begin with. It felt dusty to me, despite the fact that from 30,000 feet up, there is an evolution to the office. It isn't... there isn't a clear through line through the story historically, because the vice president's job description is largely determined by the president, and so there isn't a clear cause and effect between administrations. The archive felt a little thin. Unlike a film about the presidency, for example, there wasn't even an often photographed location like the Oval Office, because the vice president had neither a permanent office nor a permanent dwelling until the 1960s. And so my husband and I would joke that it was a little bit like the dwarf Gimli in Fellowship of the Rings. Certainty of death, small chance of success, what are we waiting for?
And yet you undertook it, and I think you ended up attacking the topic in a really striking way, and a way that I think what I find especially sort of delicious about it is you ended up pointing out something that has been true for a long time, and that probably a lot of us on some maybe subconscious or subliminal level knew and understood and yet hadn't really stopped to ponder, and namely the strangeness of the office of the vice president, especially as we look through history, and the way that, especially at the outset, the office of vice president was a very vaguely conceived one. I just find that's one of those things that makes it an especially sort of valuable public service that you've done for us.
I'm so glad. Yeah, I mean, it was a huge surprise to me, actually, because I suppose one of the things that I like best about this work is you start out a project knowing little or nothing about a given subject, and by the end of it, I wouldn't say you're an expert, but you can at least have a cogent conversation with an expert. And it was quite a surprise to me to discover how ambiguous the Constitution is about the role of the vice president. You know, it was 1787. It was a hot summer. It was quite late in the Constitutional Convention when the framers of the Constitution took on this issue. And they assigned only two responsibilities to the vice president: to cast a tie-breaking vote in the Senate and to succeed the president in the event that he was removed from office or unable to fulfill the duties of the office. But the circumstances under which the vice president would succeed to the presidency were very ambiguous, and the nature of that transition of power was also ambiguous, and it remained so for more than 180 years.
Right. One of my favorite moments in the film is when we are hearing a quote from our country's very first vice president, who eventually became our second president, namely John Adams, in highlighting what I think the film calls the paradoxy of the vice presidency, when John Adams said, "I am the vice president. In this, I am nothing, but I may be everything." And in a few short words, he's really done a marvelous job there of summarizing what at the time was the truly uncertain state of the vice presidency, what it really meant to be vice president, and it remained so for many, many years.
Absolutely. The vice president, you know, until the 1940s, really, was just sort of a figure in waiting, and spent little or no time actually presiding over the Senate. And, you know, I like to joke that it's the most pilloried post in the federal government. You know, we all know the jokes about the vice presidency, and most recently expressed by the series Veep on HBO. But the vice presidents themselves, for many, many years, contributed to the sort of national joke about the office. Richard Mentor Johnson, who was the vice president to Martin Van Buren, you know, soon after he was elected, decamped to his native Kentucky, where he spent his term running a tavern. Teddy Roosevelt anticipated being able to go to law school while he was vice president, and famously said that the office was not a stepping stone to anything other than oblivion. And so on and so forth.
Right. So in other words, it's not just comedians, but it's the vice presidents themselves in many cases speaking about the office in this sort of way. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Michelle Ferrari, writer, producer, and director of the new documentary film, The American Vice President, which airs tomorrow night on the PBS series American Experience. I want to make sure I don't neglect to pay you a compliment about a couple of things, many things actually, but I want to be sure to say how much I love the way that this film opened, with sort of a cavalcade of various images. And of course, because we're talking about early American history, this is not film footage we're seeing. It's simply still photographs that show us an array of presidents and vice presidents, and most of these faces of the vice presidents are completely unknown to us. And I just feel like you did a really, really superb job of kind of giving us a sense of this part of our own history that so many of us just don't know anything about. Can you just say a quick word about the choice of specific stills and the way in which they are sort of layered together? I think that's one of the things that can sometimes just kind of slip right past us without us properly appreciating the importance of something like that.
I really appreciate you noting that, and in answering your question, I should give a shout out to our archival producer Amanda Rose and my editor Carl Dawson, who were obviously very key to all of those decisions and having the material in the first place to work with. You know, as I said, at first blush, the archive, the visual archive, seemed a little thin. But we, you know, sort of dove in and tried to think creatively about how to use what was there, and really leaned into the ways in which the vice presidency has been regarded as a punchline, and the fact that, you know, in the 19th century anyway, most of the people who served are unknown to Americans today. And I spent an entire afternoon, you know, when we were still in pre-production, looking at campaign posters, which I decided very early on we should use because they're colorful, they scream Americana, and they are in some ways familiar to us, even though the two heads on, we were calling them the two-headed posters in the edit room, even though the two heads on the two-headed posters were unfamiliar to us, or at least the vice president was unfamiliar to us. And I think, you know, we took that sort of initial impulse and ran with it. So another body of material that we used were the joint sessions of Congress, where, and State of the Union addresses, where the vice president is seated behind the president. And you can often tell a great deal about their feelings, about their position, by the expression on their face.
And their posture.
Exactly.
By the way, so for me, for instance, in this little sequence at the outset of the film, I just loved that one of the photos we see is President Calvin Coolidge addressing Congress. And it sort of makes you realize that we so often see the same photographs over and over again. And when one thinks about the long history of our country and the rich photographic legacy, I mean, in all my life, even as a nerd of presidents, if you will, I've never laid eyes on this photograph before. And I dare say probably most Americans have never seen this particular photograph. Not that it's especially dramatic, even especially noteworthy, except we never see it. But, of course, right. This is Calvin Coolidge, one of the vice presidents who succeeded to the presidency upon the death of his predecessor, President Harding. But I just so appreciate the fact that you weren't just grabbing for the tried and true, but also showing us images that for most of us will be utterly new and unfamiliar.
That's so great to hear. Yeah, I mean, as I said, we sort of leaned into the fact that a lot of this history is unknown. I had an early conversation with my brother-in-law, who is one of the smartest people I know, and he knew nothing about the content of this film, and that was, my sister actually thanked me the next day for telling him something he didn't know.
Very good. And I want to, although we'll dig into this in more detail a little later, I want to say that we move from that opening sequence in the film then to November of 1963. And of course, everyone knows the momentous tragic occasion that we are talking about. And again, I want to pay you and your colleagues a compliment because obviously any American, especially an American of a certain age, well knows the events of November 22nd. And yet, I thought you did an utterly superb job of taking us back to that day, beginning with early in the morning when, of course, nobody could possibly foresee what was going to unfold. And in the space of really very little time, we are taken through the drama and chaos of that day. And again, with certain film clips and still photographs that I have never, ever seen before. I wonder if you could just talk briefly about the challenge of, for instance, taking us on to that all-too-familiar day, November 22nd, 1963, and yet somehow trying to do so in a way that will feel, if I can use the word, fresh. and new?
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I in particular, really felt the burden of how familiar that history is to most Americans, and particularly Americans of a certain age. And I felt like the way to address it was to acknowledge that it was familiar, and to not really play on the emotions surrounding the assassination, but to focus on the emotions that Lyndon Johnson was experiencing on that day, to come at the story from the perspective of the vice president, who was then immediately to ascend to the presidency. And I think that that just gives all too familiar events a new spin.
Absolutely. And one of the ways you do that is that we hear the voice of his wife, the Lady Bird Johnson, excerpts from that extraordinary oral history that she herself recorded, in which we are really taken into their car in the motorcade and are told exactly what happened as those shots rang out, and Vice President Johnson is dragged to the floor of the car with a Secret Service agent over him without any of them knowing exactly what had happened, but protecting the vice president in that dramatic moment was of supreme importance. And again, I don't mean to belabor the point, but one of the images we see in this sequence is a still photograph of Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird Johnson riding in the same motorcade. And again, most of us have seen dozens, if not hundreds, maybe thousands of images from that motorcade. I don't ever remember seeing an image that showed us the Johnsons, who of course were just a couple of cars behind the limousine carrying the president and his wife.
That's correct, but you know, Lyndon Johnson was not the focus of the day.
Absolutely.
So,
but in some ways, he is, you know, the focus of your film, because of course, what ensues then prompts a new discussion about the nature of the office of the vice presidency and the whole matter of succession. We're speaking with Michelle Ferrari about a documentary film that will air tomorrow night on PBS's series American Experience, the film called The American Vice President. So from that, from the dramatic events of November 22nd, we are taken through in fairly quick fashion, yet surprisingly thorough fashion, those many decades of our country's history in which the vice president operated under this strange paradox of it being, on the one hand, a high office, and yet not all that high. I mean, an office so ill-defined. And then, of course, we are taken through the story of those vice presidents who were called upon to step into the office of the president. And I think your film does a really fine job of describing, in particular, the first such vice president, John Tyler, succeeding William Henry Harrison, who dies essentially 30 days after his inauguration. Tell our listeners about the strange position that Mr. Tyler was placed in, and the widely varying opinions on exactly who John Tyler was after the death of William Henry Harrison.
So William Henry Harrison succumbs to pneumonia, as you said, barely a month after his inauguration. And his vice president, as soon as he hears the news, arranges to take the oath of office. And this caused a great deal of controversy because there were many people who read the Constitution to mean that the vice president would serve only as acting president until there was a new election. But John Tyler insisted that he was president, refused to even open mail addressed to the acting vice president, and was considered by the press to be a usurper. He was called His Accidency, the Great Usurper, but he set a precedent, the Tyler precedent, that was then followed thereafter. Seven presidents came into the presidency based on the Tyler precedent. That included Andrew Johnson, John Tyler, Millard Fillmore, Andrew Johnson, Chester Arthur, Theodore Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, Harry Truman, and Lyndon Johnson.
One of the things that is so interesting about the story of John Tyler, and again, you know, you're talking to someone who really knows the history of the U.S. presidency pretty darn well. I mean, I would count myself above average, at least. But it had never really dawned on me, this whole question of, is he actually the president, or is he just the acting president? I mean, is he really still the vice president, but moving into the duties, assuming the responsibilities of president, the same way that someone is the acting general manager of a radio station, but not actually the general manager. And it's just so interesting to think about that really difficult question that most of us have not really stopped to ponder. And suddenly, here is the country struggling with this very issue. And I was going to say John Tyler as well, except it doesn't seem like for him it was much of a struggle. To him, it seemed like an open and shut case. I am the new president.
Correct. That's exactly right. And I think, you know, most of us have never stopped to ponder it because for most of us, for most of our lifetimes, it hasn't been an issue because the 25th Amendment clarified the protocols for transfer of power.
Right. So your film, I think, is doing such a great job of helping us understand the desperate need for such clarity. I especially appreciate the story of Chester Arthur, who was the vice president when James Garfield was struck down by an assassin's bullet. But he, as many Americans know, did not die immediately, and in fact lingered for some 6 months before finally succumbing to his grievous injuries. Describe what Vice President Chester Arthur was doing during these months in which James Garfield lay utterly incapacitated.
Sadly, Chester Arthur was not doing much because he was very uncertain of his authority to step in because of the ambiguity in the Constitution and his unwillingness to appear the usurper. And there was a concern that if anyone acted to transfer power to Arthur, that it would displace Garfield, as, you know, according to the Tyler precedent. And Arthur, like Tyler, would become president. And Garfield would be ousted even if he recovered.
It's such an interesting quandary. And, of course, as you say, Chester Arthur, lacking anything in the way of clear guidance from the Constitution, is essentially an idle bystander. And the country, for all intents and purposes, is operating without a functioning president for that entire time. Your film also takes us ahead into the early 20th century when President Woodrow Wilson, in 1919, is stricken with what appears now to have been a very serious and debilitating stroke, but this was a situation very much shielded from the American public. That is, at least the seriousness of what had befallen President Wilson. Explain how this very, very difficult situation was handled and the role that the vice president at the time played.
Well, as Wilson languished for the better part of 6 months, his wife and his secretary basically tried to keep his condition a secret. And Wilson's vice president, Thomas Marshall, let that happen and stood to the side, and was later quoted as saying that he didn't really want to tangle with a woman, not least if it was the president's wife. I've always found it quite fascinating that Mrs. Wilson was basically running the country because she was against women having the vote.
So a really interesting matter there. And a similar, not entirely identical situation, but a similar situation arises more than once during the two terms of President Dwight D. Eisenhower, namely President Eisenhower being felled, I think, at one point by a serious heart attack, at another point felled by a stroke, and on another, at least one other occasion, hospitalized for a completely different health difficulty. And, of course, one Richard Nixon is the vice president at the time. Your film reveals something that I think will be completely unknown to most of us, namely what is called, I think, a gentleman's agreement between President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon. Explain what this is about.
Well, I mean, by the time Eisenhower is president, the role of the president has changed dramatically, say, from the mid-19th century or the late 19th century. We've gone from being the president of the United States to being the leader of the free world. And as the role of the president changes, so too does the role of the vice president. And presidents begin to pull their vice president into the workings of the executive branch in a more profound way. And Nixon is really the first to inhabit that new vision of the vice presidency. And because Eisenhower was very aware of the ambiguity in the Constitution surrounding the vice presidency and succession, and because he was also painfully aware of his own, fragile health condition, he had the Justice Department draw up a memo, a letter that both he and Nixon signed, that said essentially that Nixon would step in and handle things until Eisenhower felt that he could resume duties of the office. And it was apparently, very friendly and unstressful between them, but it didn't have the force of law, so it really left the nation in a pretty precarious situation.
Right. And one of the experts that you have on hand to discuss all this raises the really intriguing point of, what if there had been some sort of dispute? And, of course, right. It's really true. It's often a very complicated matter in terms of how completely or if at all someone is incapacitated, and at what point is it appropriate for someone else to, in a sense, step in and take the reins.
Exactly.
It's around this time, actually, in the film that someone raises another very intriguing point. I think it might be Rachel Maddow who raises the question of if John F. Kennedy had actually survived the assassination, if it had just been an attempted assassination, surely even if he had pulled through somehow, he would have been left incapacitated to some extent, perhaps completely. And what would have happened under that difficult circumstance? It's out of this uncertainty that a gentleman by the name of John Feerick writes what turns out to be an important article about this constitutional ambiguity. And remarkably, he is part of your film. Tell our listeners who he was, who he is, and the important part he plays at the early stages of this part of this unfolding story.
John Feerick is the Dean Emeritus of the Fordham Law School, and he was in law school, a law student himself, during the Eisenhower administration, and he was aware of Eisenhower's many trips to the hospital and long convalescences, and kind of decided to focus on this issue of presidential inability and succession. And he wrote an article that was published shortly before Kennedy's assassination. And as he says in the film, he thought it was going to go on a library shelf somewhere, but it was an important topic, and he had decided to commit himself to it. So there you have it. But then Kennedy was assassinated, and all of a sudden John Fearick got all kinds of calls wanting him to be on programs and, you know, could they interview him for the newspaper and so on and so forth. He became, as a member of the American Bar Association, very involved in the drafting of the 25th Amendment, what would become the 25th Amendment.
Right. One thing that is an interesting matter explored in your film is why the urgency about this. Because at one point we're told that if one totals up all of the time in our country's history in which our nation functioned without a vice president, that is, for instance, the nearly 4 years that John Tyler served as our president, our 10th president, we did not have a vice president. There were no provisions whatsoever to fill that vacancy, and we simply went on without a vice president. And that happened again with Andrew Johnson, it happened with Chester Arthur, and so on. And in many cases, we're talking about nearly 4 years because of the timing of these various assassinations and deaths. 36 years altogether, the United States had functioned pretty well without anybody in the office of vice president. And yet there is a new and profound sense of urgency about this being rectified. Explain the era in which the country found itself, which made all of this seem to be much, much more important, this matter of succession and so on.
Well, I will say, just taking it back a little bit, that the concern, the alarm bell started to ring during the Eisenhower administration. Because by that point, we're operating in a world where there are nuclear weapons. And the fact that, there was no clarity around this issue definitely was a cause for concern, even in the late 1950s. And Congress debated this issue at length in the late 1950s, but could come to no agreement about it because protecting the presidential prerogatives in a case of inability proved a very divisive issue. One of the senators involved in the debate said, when you have three congressmen talking about inability, you have 17 different opinions.
Yeah.
And so there was no resolution to it. And when Kennedy was assassinated, I think, you know, the level of alarm just escalated, not because the world had changed dramatically between 1956 and 1963, although by 1963 there's the civil rights movement and civil rights leaders are being assassinated and, you know, we have advisors on the ground in Vietnam. But it was more that it had become intolerable. And we were very fortunate to have this freshman senator, Birch Bayh, who had recently been appointed to the Subcommittee on Constitutional Amendments, and he took this on. And he was energetic and positive and managed to convince his colleagues on Capitol Hill over the course of a couple of years that it was important to focus on what they could agree on, to find consensus. And to recognize that whatever they did was not going to cover every contingency, but that it would be better than what we had on the books already.
Absolutely.
And so they managed to get the 25th Amendment passed and ratified.
Just ahead of us being introduced to Senator Birch Bayh, there are a couple of really telling points to your documentary. One of them is when we see the new President Lyndon Johnson addressing Congress, and we see behind him the Speaker of the House and the President Pro Temp of the Senate, who are next in line, both very, very elderly gentlemen, and one suddenly realizes, you know, what might happen if something happened to Lyndon Johnson. But the other then is when we see a few moments from a CBS documentary airing right around this time, a documentary titled The Crisis of Presidential Succession. Just seeing a little bit of it made me hungry to see that entire program maybe someday if it is ever available in somehow. But it's telling that an outfit like CBS News was devoting primetime airtime to this very issue.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the wake of Kennedy's assassination, this absolutely shot to the top of the national agenda. I mean, as a filmmaker focused on American history, I love CBS reports. I think there's been a CBS reports excerpt in virtually every one of my films. But they did really good in-depth work, but it was not by no means the only media attention given to this issue in 1963. It was the subject of many editorials and headlines and newspaper articles and
sure.
magazine articles.
And it's interesting, not just that they put together a program about this, but they titled it The Crisis of Presidential Succession. It says it right there, the sense of urgency that the makers of this program and many, many Americans were feeling at that time. I appreciate the fact that as you talk about Senator Bayh's efforts with his subcommittee on constitutional amendments, you talk about the extensive and complicated discussions that ensued, in which they were, in a sense, trying to explore and consider and weigh all kinds of different possibilities, some of them all but unimaginable. Can you just talk for a moment about this part of the story and what this committee was, in a sense, reckoning with in trying to shape what ultimately became the 25th Amendment?
Well, as I said, a large part of these conversations around presidential inability and succession have to do with avoiding a scenario like we had with Garfield, where there's a possibility that the elected president of the United States is sidelined. And so protecting presidential prerogatives was very, very important. And no one could quite agree about how to do this. They're imagining all these things that might happen to a president, tragedies that might befall a president, an atomic attack on the Capitol, being kidnapped, et cetera, et cetera. And how do you make sure that the country continues to function, but that the president does not lose his place? And people could not agree about that. They couldn't agree about, who was to make the call. Was it to be a doctor or the cabinet members or, some other elected officials? And they went around and around and around and around and around. But as I said, Bayh was very, very focused on finding consensus. And one thing that's interesting that didn't make it into the film is that, as you said, the people next in line for the presidency while Johnson was, when Johnson had succeeded to the office and was acting without a vice president, one was 72 and the other was 86. The Speaker of the House was 72. And, Birch Bayh sets in motion his resolution for a new constitutional amendment very shortly after Kennedy's assassination. And his people contacted Johnson's office and said, we want Johnson's support for this amendment. And Johnson, in fact, did support the amendment, but he would not come out publicly and say so for fear of offending the Speaker of the House.
Wow. Fascinating.
It wasn't until he was, reelected with a vice president that he came out in support of the 25th Amendment, which is part of the reason it took, almost 3 years on Capitol Hill to pass.
Wow. We're speaking with Michelle Ferrari, talking about her remarkable film, The American Vice President, which airs tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. The final portion of your film also takes us through events that most Americans are quite well acquainted with, and yet, as I said with some earlier portions of the film, I think you've done an exceptionally fine job of taking us through these well-traveled events in the early 1970s from a slightly different perspective, from the perspective of what all of this meant, not only for the U.S. presidency, but for the U.S. vice presidency. And of course, we are talking about Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, Gerald Ford, and all that that unfolded in those tumultuous years. Say a quick word about the interesting role that Spiro Agnew played as Richard Nixon's vice president.
You know, the press often referred to him as Nixon's attack dog. was sort of gifted with words, I suppose, loved alliteration, and was very fond of throwing verbal bombs and antagonizing the press, sort of enabled Nixon to stay above the fray while taking on all of the issues that, you know, were Nixon's bugaboos. When they were elected for the second time in 1972, they won by a landslide. It was a very effective partnership in that respect.
That is for sure. And, of course, it is not long thereafter that Spiro Agnew becomes engulfed in a horrific scandal of his own. Ultimately, it is a scandal that brings him down, despite his fiery insistence that he was never going to step down, but in fact, he absolutely must. And only through a plea bargain, agreeing to step down, does he ultimately avoid what almost certainly would have been time in prison for his wrongdoing. And Nixon then is faced with this situation of who will succeed Spiro Agnew and who he should choose for that important role, knowing that he himself was at that point already in serious peril. You draw in then to this story something unexpected, the role of the Speaker of the House at the time, a Democrat by the name of Carl Albert. Say a word about what makes this already intriguing story even more intriguing, with the presence of Carl Albert in the midst of this situation.
Well, as you said, Carl Albert was a Democrat, and keep in mind that Agnew and Nixon had been elected in a landslide, and Albert is presented with, you know, two issues at once. On the one hand, Agnew has resigned, and Albert has responsibility in the House for confirming a new vice president. The 25th Amendment has given the president the power to nominate a new VP, and, you know, subject to confirmation by a majority of both houses of Congress. So Albert is responsible for that confirmation vote in the House, and he's simultaneously facing the prospect that Nixon will need to be impeached, and he will have to handle that process in the House. And as one of our interviewees, Rachel Maddow, points out in the film, if he had been of a particular mindset, he could have engineered fulfilling neither of those responsibilities and thereby becoming himself president of the United States.
Right. If the impeachment hearings had proceeded briskly, and then the confirmation hearings for Gerald Ford, if those had been slowed, we could have easily ended up with Nixon gone and Gerald Ford not yet in place, and Carl Albert would have found himself as our 38th president. But, of course,
exactly.
Fortunately, that is not how he conducted himself in that moment. Your film also tells us that because Richard Nixon was politically imperiled at this point, the confirmation hearings for Gerald Ford were quite unprecedented in terms of the extraordinary scrutiny under which he was placed.
The FBI dispatched 350 agents. They fanned out across the country from 33 different field offices to investigate every aspect of Ford's life. And again, this is not in the film, but one of the things I found hilarious was that a couple of agents actually delved into Ford's experience as a college football player and were investigating reports of unnecessary penalties he'd received for unnecessary roughness.
Wow.
Which, I just sort of love.
Wow. Well, of course, Gerald Ford is ultimately confirmed as vice president and, of course, ultimately accedes to the presidency when Mr. Nixon is forced to resign. And although this transition is largely seamless, your film reveals a couple of interesting, let's say, complications, particularly one involving where Gerald Ford and Betty Ford were going to live. Would you mind sharing this very intriguing moment from the film?
Sure. I guess I will say, to begin with, imagine that you become president without ever having planned to become president. So you haven't run a campaign. There's been no preparation. Just, you know, one day you're vice president, the next day you're president. And there was really very little time where he knew he was going to become president. So he and Betty were still living in their colonial house in Virginia. And the Nixons had not yet moved out of the White House. Nixon had resigned. He'd, you know, flown to California, but their belongings were still in the White House. And the Fords gave them some time to move out. So you have the president and the first lady living in suburban Virginia, which is crazy to contemplate. And this is, you know, a mere decade after Kennedy was assassinated. So there was a lot of work to do on the little suburban house to make it secure for the president of the United States.
Such a fascinating moment in our history and one largely obscure, and I appreciate so much that your film shares that. And in the closing minutes of the film, we're given, in a sense, a bit of a summary of how much more significant the office of vice president is now compared to even just a few years before, in something as basic as size of staff and whether or not there's an official office and so on. I mean, it is remarkable to think about how far the office of the vice presidency has come.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, the 25th Amendment opened the door, as Joel Goldstein, who is, you know, an expert on the vice presidency, says in the film. It articulated a new vision of the vice presidency, and that new vision was really realized, although this is not part of the film, was really realized by the Carter-Mondale administration. And virtually every vice president in the years since has acted as a partner to the president, a partner in governance. And some have had more to do and some less to do, but we do now regard the office in a way that would be completely unfamiliar to the framers of the Constitution. Hmm.
Well, I, for one, thoroughly enjoyed your film start to finish and learned so much, and I know everyone who watches it will have the same experience. The American Experience film, The American Vice President, will air tomorrow night on Milwaukee Channel 10 and on PBS stations across the country. And the writer, producer, director of this film, Michelle Ferrari. Michelle Ferrari, congratulations on an absolutely wonderful film. And thank you so much for being my morning show guest.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on the morning show, local writer Robert Katzman, who has written a multi-volume memoir of his interesting life, the first volume of which is titled Lost Boy, on Beating a Child, in which he talks about his difficult childhood and the experience of surviving abuse. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Sunny and warm today, a high of 79 degrees with breezy conditions overnight and a low of 58. Tomorrow sunny and a little cooler with tomorrow's high 68 degrees. Wednesday's high 73, Thursday's high 76, back into the 60s for a daytime high both Friday and Saturday. At the moment, we have nothing but pleasant sunshine now through Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. WPR News.